Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Russian President Putin's op-ed in the New York Times, a plea for caution from Russia, and speak with Fiona Hill, a specialist on Russia at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We will discuss how Putin skillfully plays his weak hand while the United States clumsily plays its strong hand. Then we will speak with an expert on chemical weapons at the Stimson Center, Brian Finley, to find out, in the event that the U.S.-Russian deal to disarm Syrian chemical weapons goes through, how this vast arsenal can be corralled and destroyed in the midst of a civil war, when 16 years after signing onto the international ban, the U.S. still has not gotten rid of all of the world's second-largest chemical weapons arsenal. Then finally, we'll hear from the author of an article in The Atlantic, Stop Blaming Colonial Borders for the Middle East's Problems, to get an alternative view on the roots of the current turmoil in Syria. Nick Danforth, the editor of the cartography blog MidAfternoonMap.com, joins us to discuss how the pernicious policies of divide and rule that the British and French colonists used to sustain their power are more responsible for the post-Arab Spring chaos in the Middle East. And joining us now is Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs, who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy, and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book just out, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fiona Hill.
Oh, thanks, Ian.
And clearly, Vladimir Putin's op-ed in the New York Times is designed to appeal to an American audience. And I don't know the extent to which he's trying to drive a wedge between the American audience and the President of the United States. But he certainly succeeded in pushing a bunch of buttons. What's your analysis of it?
Well, Putin himself prides himself on this very act of communicating with people. He's always talking about this. It's one of the skills that he picked up in the KGB, working with and communicating with people. However, Putin likes to do these in very constrained formats and with very specific targeted audiences. He's not the kind of guy who really likes to wade into a crowd and then deal with whatever comes at him as it's happening. So what he's done here, clearly, is he's taken his cue very carefully. He even says it in the op-ed from the president's address to the nation. He's picked up on the president's words to throw right back at him. And he's clearly aiming over the head of the president, not to the American public at large. I mean, not everybody in the U.S. reads the New York Times, as we well know. It's a very elite, very specific audience that he's trying to engage with. It's people like you and I, and many of the listeners of KPFK. It's also many of the members of Congress. In fact, I mean, they all get briefings every day. I'm sure this was at the top of everybody's briefing in Congress and in the Senate as soon as it was out. It's the media. It's the chattering classes, as we often call them. It's people in think tanks. It's analysts. It's the educated population who are engaged all the time in foreign policy. And what he's trying to do is just to underscore the issues that he lays out there, that the U.S. cannot go it alone, that there's a United Nations international process. And he's also kind of appealing to some of the commentary he's already seen, or his people around him have already seen, opposing any kind of U.S. unilateral military strike in Syria.
So in a sense, it seems to me, Fiona Hill, that Vladimir Putin plays a very weak hand incredibly skillfully, and the United States, by contrast, plays a very strong hand rather clumsily. At least, you know, the back and forth in the last few days of accidental diplomacy where John Kerry, slip of the tongue, committed the president to a public address on Iraq, which the president hadn't mentioned, and then his rhetorical slip of the tongue at a press conference in London, where he basically said the only way the Syrians can avoid being bombed is giving up their chemical weapons, and of course they're not going to do that. And Putin seized on that. I mean, if you compare, for example, just looking at the UN figures on global GDP, the United States is number one, obviously, and Russia is at 10th place, U.S. with a $15 trillion GDP and Russia with a $1.8 trillion GDP. So if that's a measurement, I think it gives you an idea of the relative strength and weakness. Do you agree with my notion that Putin plays a weak hand skillfully while we play a strong hand rather clumsily?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, that's something that he also can always turn to his advantage, our own strengths, the strengths at least on the surface. But well, there's also weaknesses, as we all know, in those strengths. By being the only remaining world superpower, we have to be involved in almost every different instance. And or people expect us to be involved in every crisis, large or small. We're seen as the indispensable power. Putin can pick and choose, and he picks his battles very carefully. In the case of Syria, he actually has some really important interests at play here. And so he's going to do whatever it takes to outsmart the United States, to get us off balance, and to push our own strengths and our own words against us. He's looking for every opportunity to capitalize on something, a mistake, a misstep, and to turn that to his advantage. In the case of what you've just laid out there with John Kerry making a couple of gaffes that turned things in a very different direction from perhaps what the United States would have anticipated, Putin has been just waiting on the sidelines, watching for these kinds of things to happen. And he comes forward with this proposal on Syria that is not especially original. Ever since he made the proposal, or he pushed it out there and Kerry himself opened the door for it, we've had this discussion about how this had been discussed in diplomatic circles behind the scenes for quite some considerable time. So Putin knows that there was already an idea out there, so it's even easier for him to step forward and to put something out where other people had already been suggesting it and talking about it, but it didn't look particularly feasible. So exactly as you said, Putin knows that he only has a limited set of cards to play, but he chooses his timing very carefully, and he waits for that exact moment where he can press the advantage. Now, the other thing, however, to make here point out here is that he makes mistakes too, and there are several issues in that op-ed where I think there might be an opportunity for us to move back in a different direction and try to regain the advantage. One of them is his continued insistence that it was likely the rebels that used the poison gas, as he puts it, in Syria. And that's something, of course, that will be fully in the spotlight when the United Nations Commission and inspectors have finished their report. So we'll see whether Vladimir Putin has to try to step around that issue.
Well, he added to that something that seems very, very off the wall after he'd mentioned that the opposition forces used chemical weapons to provoke intervention by their powerful foreign patrons, which I imagine is the US and Saudi Arabia,
right,
who would be siding with the fundamentalists. Reports that militants are preparing another attack, this time against Israel, cannot be ignored. Where's the evidence for that?
Well, it's a good question. But this is, again, classic Putin. He picks up on something that may have been out there in various reports or newspaper reports, I mean, maybe perhaps in the Russian press. And then he tries to spin this again to his advantage. It could be a complete red herring. But the interesting thing here on the use of just the idea of an attack against Israel is that when you look at Russia's position in the Middle East, it's a little precarious. It's not just that they have these alliances with Assad and Syria and the relationship with Iran, but Russia actually has a very good relationship with Israel right now. I want to just stress this point, that we're not in a Cold War game here in the Middle East. Russia is not the same player as the Soviet Union was, when the Soviet Union was always siding with the Palestinians, the PLO, and many other actors that were seen as antithetical to U.S. interests. Russia's actually really changed its position on a number of alliances and relationships, and Israel is a case in point. Very different setup there. Many of the Russian Jews who moved, and Soviet Jews who were Russian-speaking, who moved to Israel over the last 10, 20 years, have created a constituency in favor of a closer relationship with Russia. And Putin has exploited that, and there's some genuine interest on his part and some genuine affinity with Israel and improving the relationship, as many Israeli political figures will tell you. So they're in a bit of a bind here, and Putin has to do some fancy footwork to be able to balance all of these competing interests in his own policy in the Middle East. So, he may catch himself out.
Again, I'm speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs, who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book just out, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Now, on the one hand, Fiona Hill, it would seem that it's not a good idea to humiliate Russia publicly and by taking out Assad or his regime. That's not what we're threatened to do, but I think it's also a subtext of what we might be preparing to do. And if he can't defend his own only ally and his only base in the Mediterranean, it's not helpful, I think, to humiliate him. But on the other hand, it's also worth reminding our audience that from day one, Putin has basically frustrated any efforts to bring Assad to account. And most of the analysts I talk to on Syria say that had the U.S. moved vigorously when the revolution first started, when Assad was on his back foot, and that was a time when Hillary Clinton was confidently saying he's going to fall, had we done something beyond rhetoric that proved to be inaccurate, we might have had a chance then. But now that the Saudis have allowed these jihadis in, who justify, in effect, Assad's rule, we are in a possible situation.
That's absolutely right. And Putin was obviously well aware of that right from the very beginning. But he does not want to see Assad fall. And the question, of course, is why? Is it just to protect his ally in the region, as you point out in the question? There's a bigger issue at stake here. Putin doesn't want to see regime change in any country, frankly, because he worries that this may eventually raise the specter of regime change in Russia itself. He's opposed U.S. military interventions across the board, and of course, he very grudgingly accepted the proposition of an intervention in Libya, because he was somewhat in the background then as prime minister when Dmitry Medvedev was president, and ever since then, he has criticized that decision of his former Russian president and his colleague Dmitry Medvedev for allowing that to happen. He's made it very clear that intervention to change regimes is antithetical to his views. And then there's his question that he lays out in the op-ed: what happens next in Syria? Who keeps the country in check? And he throws back at the United States in this op-ed, obviously, all of the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, and talking about the worsening of the situations there. Putin wants Assad to stay because he sees Assad as the last bastion against chaos in Syria, and that's in spite of all of his flaws. I don't think Putin has any illusions whatsoever about Assad's abilities or the way that he will conduct himself. But Putin looks at the alternatives to Assad and he doesn't see one. And he is perfectly happy to have Assad brutalize the Syrian population to keep the disintegration, the complete disintegration of the country in check. And we have to remember that Putin has done exactly the same in his own civil war in Chechnya. He came into office in 1999 against the renewal of war in Chechnya, and he presided over a very bloody struggle, pretty much similar in scale to what we're seeing in Syria now, although I have to say that Syria, the broader implications of this are much, much larger than what we saw in Chechnya. And he wants to give Assad a fighting chance to basically wrest some kind of control over the situation. So that's where we really differ from Russia over the issue of Syria. He wants to see stability in the longer term. He doesn't care particularly about democracy. I mean, I think he makes that relatively clear in the op-ed as well when you start parsing the language there. And he's got a very strong stomach for the kind of slaughter that we find completely reprehensible and basically unacceptable. Vladimir Putin has been there, done that, seen that, and that is not going to motivate him to change his position on Syria.
But in effect, it would seem, Fiona Hill, if we go ahead and this deal goes down, even though there's obviously a lot of problems getting rid of a chemical weapons arsenal, a fairly substantial one in the midst of a civil war, but assuming we go ahead with the Russian deal, we're selling out the majority of the Syrians who opposed the regime, and the regime, if it's able to consolidate, will slaughter the rest of its opponents. So we're definitely selling out the so-called Free Syrian Army. But in terms of touching the buttons with the American audience, which is clearly weary of war due to the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice lies about WMDs that didn't exist, now, of course, make rogue states want to get WMDs. He makes reference, of course, to that notion that he's saying here, thus a growing number of countries seek to acquire weapons of mass destruction. This is logical. If you have the bomb, no one will touch you. We are left with talk of the need to strengthen nonproliferation when in reality this is being eroded. Now, if we could take him at his word here, and if the US and Russia can work effectively to disarm Syria at the same time, as I point out, selling out the revolution, maybe that same model could be applied to Iran. So there's something positive there, don't you think?
Well, there is. And I think that's the challenge for us now. Basically, Putin has moved the game in a certain direction, and he's taken advantage of our missteps. And right now, it's Mr. Putin who has scored on this one. The challenge for us now is to put the ball back in our court and for us to be able to turn the situation to our advantage and start to move in the direction that we want to see this. We have to make sure that we don't completely sell out the Syrian Free Army and all of the other positive forces in Syria that are really trying to push for a genuine change in the way that Syria is managed and is governed. I think our big problem now is that we're much more looking like the kind of scenario that we saw in the Balkans and, you know, the 90s onwards. But, you know, when you start to think about the slaughter in the Balkans and where we ended up with Dayton, with someone as accomplished as Richard Holbrook really trying to script out what happened next, it wasn't that terrible an outcome. It wasn't the outcome that we would have liked to have seen with all of the piecemeal carving up of what was Yugoslavia. And unfortunately, that's maybe what we're going to be looking at in the case of Syria, another reconfiguration of that state. But if we can do this in a way where we're writing the script, if we're moving forward and we try to salvage something out of this, it's not necessarily a terrible outcome here. So that's where you're right, where there may be something that we can make out of this. And also with an eye to these other cases where we have to deal with this issue of non-proliferation, of disarmament, and really curbing the use of chemical weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. If we play our own cards right now and remembering that we do have certain strengths, we can turn this to our advantage. I guess the question has to be, are we able to do that? We've got to think very carefully now, I think, about who we put in charge of this, who we send out to deal with Putin, how we handle ourselves, and we have to really be very clear about what it is that we're trying to do here.
Well, just in closing, Fiona Hill, the Dayton Accords, of course, happened because the U.S. used force. But just to finish up with what Putin finished up with in his op-ed, where he said he took on the case of American exceptionalism, stating that the United States policy is what makes America different. It what makes us exceptional, quoting Obama there. It is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional. Whatever the motivation, there are big countries and small countries, rich and poor, those with long democratic traditions and those still finding their way to democracy. Their policies differ too. We are all different. But when we ask for the Lord's blessing, we must not forget that God created us equal. Now, it's true that all of our presidents rather jingoistically always end their addresses by saying God bless America or God bless the United States, and it seems to be a political ritual here. You think that Putin has thrown this back at Obama effectively?
Not effectively, but he's certainly thrown it back, and that was actually the paragraph that you know, I found myself the most offensive when I really thought about what the Russians were trying to do with this in terms of their public diplomacy and trying to find things that would resonate with an American audience. I think this is where they lost it in the last paragraph. I mean, there's obviously some pretty rank hypocrisy in there, but, you know, everybody tends to be hypocritical about these kinds of things in public affairs and global diplomacy. President Putin's entire base since he came into office in 1999 has been predicated on Russian exceptionalism. I mean, he came out in his very first address talking about Russia being a standalone civilization that had to go back to its own values and reject copying Western models. So he probably, or whoever wrote this for him, that they could have added an additional line about God created as equal, but some more equal than others, in the words of Animal Farm. Because certainly Putin has said over and over again on so many occasions that there are only a few truly sovereign nations in the world, and Russia is one of those very, very few that really stand for something unique in terms of their national sovereignty, their statehood, etc. So, you know, this here was really where it was the kind of the most blatant attempt at manipulating and pushing back again the words of President Obama and the United States are back in a different footing. And President Putin is going to be presiding over the next week, and at least people in the Kremlin are, over a meeting of international experts of Valdai Discussion Club, where they're going to talk about Russian identity and essentially Russian exceptionalism. So, I mean, this really underscores, in many respects, what Putin was trying to do here, which is really change the discussion, push and refute, push back and refute the words of President Obama, and really, you know, essentially just underscore again how he is playing with words and with issues to try to do this to his own effect. So, well, I mean, for me, that paragraph was the one. If they'd left that out, I think, you know, a lot of the other arguments that they were making could have been quite compelling. It was really, in a way, that last paragraph that showed President Putin's hand.
Well, Fiona Hill, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book just out, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a chemical weapons specialist on how difficult it is to get rid of these weapons. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Finley, who is a chemical weapons expert and senior associate at the Stimson Center, where he directs the center's Managing Across Boundaries initiative. Previously, he was a senior researcher at the Brookings Institution and a program officer at the Century Foundation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Finley.
Thank you so much, Ian. You have a Brookings theme today.
Well, it's an accident, but a welcome one. So the presidents have often said that we can't allow the world's most dangerous weapons ending up in the hands of the world's most dangerous people. Well, of course, that's a little bit like water under the bridge. If you consider Assad dangerous, certainly a lot of his people do. But now, of course, Vladimir Putin is saying it's the rebels who fired the rocket full of sarin, or the rockets full of sarin. So what's your sense then of how, assuming this deal goes through, how's it going to be executed? How do you get rid of one of the world's largest chemical arsenals in the midst of a civil war?
Yeah, it's a great question, Ian, and it really is obviously an incredibly complicated and time-consuming and also expensive process, and also potentially dangerous on a number of fronts, not only for those who will be ultimately executing the destruction process, but for those citizens that live in and around the multiple storage sites that exist in Syria and ultimately which will become ultimately destruction sites. So there are obviously multiple challenges that we can certainly get into. The broad steps behind how this should ostensibly take place, and we have word, of course, today that the Assad regime has acceded to the Chemical Weapons Convention. That itself is a time-consuming process. He has essentially submitted the instruments of accession. They will be ultimately deposited at the OPCW. It'll be a 30-day process, and then 30 days later, they will become a member. So, we're not quite even yet at the point where we have, the political capacity to begin executing on a destruction plan. Then we have obviously a very complicated process that is launched from that point on. The first stage is essentially for the government in Syria to undertake a comprehensive examination of the full stockpile. That includes not just their chemical munitions, but also vast quantities of agents that we suspect that they have, an accounting of their production facilities, of their research facilities. There are five production facilities, we believe. We don't know that for sure. Then we'll move to a point where all that information will be shipped to The Hague, the headquarters of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. It will be verified by the OPCW, and then we will move to actual the destruction phase of this. So this is a months-long process before we even begin to destroy the first chemical munition.
And of course, Secretary of State Kerry has already said it's unacceptable. I mean, he doesn't want to wait for 30 days, for example, for the certification. He wants to move ahead more quickly than that. So is it possible to do this with the Russian and the Americans under the UN umbrella and get those people in sooner?
It absolutely is. Of course, that in and of itself requires, the political agreement of the Assad regime. It requires an environment in which these inspectors can go in a safe environment and undertake their activities. That obviously does not currently exist on the ground in Syria at the moment. We also have no sense as to what state their chemical stockpile is in. If the stockpile that the Russians held, the United States and other countries helped disassemble in the immediate wake of the Cold War, is any indication, it is possible that these chemical munitions that the Assad government has are some in very good shape that are obviously weapons usable and have obviously been used on the outskirts of Damascus in late August. Others, however, we don't know what the state is. They could well be rotting in warehouses and could be extremely volatile. So there are a number of political complications that gets us to the point of destruction, and then there are clear technical complications as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Brian Finley, who's a chemical weapons expert and senior associate at the Stimson Center, where he directs the center's Managing Across Boundaries initiative. Previously, he was a senior researcher at the Brookings Institution and a program officer at the Century Foundation. Now, there are a couple of precedents of getting rid of chemical arsenal. One under the United Nations, the so-called UNSCOM regime. I just spoke before we went on the air with an UNSCOM weapons inspector who explained how they destroyed the stockpiles in Iraq, where they did it on site. That is obviously the only way to do it, right? But the other example, of course, is Libya. Now, Gaddafi had agreed when he had his road to Damascus conversion and then gave up his nuclear program and exposed his chemical program as well, and a lot of that actually led to the AQ Khan network. But that was not complete, was it, by the time the Syrian revolution took place and then the NATO intervention?
No, you're absolutely right, Ian. So it was December, as you recall, of 2003 when Gaddafi had his conversion. He agreed to begin surrendering his stockpiles of chemical weapons, as well as obviously came clean on his nuclear program. Activities got underway. Again, it took a long time to actually get the process up and running. The program did start the destruction on site in Libya. It was interrupted by the Arab Spring in early 2011. It was resumed in late 2011 by the interim government. Then a technical malfunction essentially halted the destruction program. And now 9 years later, we're still working in Libya to destroy that chemical stockpile. And that was for a chemical stockpile, bear in mind, Ian, that was around 25 metric tons. If intelligence estimates are correct in Syria, we're talking about a chemical stockpile of close to 1,000 metric tons of chemical agents. So orders of magnitude larger, orders of magnitude more time-consuming, orders of magnitude less safe in the environment that we were even dealing with in Libya, and orders of magnitude obviously more costly.
But just to compare this, just to give an idea how difficult this process is, let's look at the United States example. The United States has, after the Soviet Union, has the world's second largest chemical weapons stockpile. 16 years ago, it joined the convention banning chemical weapons. Am I right on that date? I mean, it actually joined earlier, but I think the implementation was about 16 years ago.
Exactly. The entry into force was in 1997.
Right. So then they started to destroy these weapons. And then what they found was that they had, five sites. And because of local political pressure, and various congressional districts and interests weighing in, they didn't want to transport all of these chemical weapons to the one site where they could have been destroyed. So they had to make, four other destruction sites, which added enormously to the costs and delayed it, right? And at this point, 16 years later, my understanding is they've only destroyed, they have destroyed up to about 80%. Is that right?
That's correct, Ian. So we started back in 1997 with a declared stockpile of around just over 31,000 tons of chemical agent. You're quite correct in your characterization some of the political challenges. There were also some technical challenges as well that related to the political. So in order to destroy this stuff, there are essentially two different methods that one might pursue. Early on in the U.S. program, the United States government decided on the first method, which is an incineration method, which is essentially bringing the chemical munitions in, draining the liquid, feeding the liquid into a liquid incinerator, and burning it at 2,700 degrees. The munitions are then burned in a metal furnace, and the ash is disposed of as hazardous waste. There was a growing movement across the United States early on in the destruction program that this was seen by local residents as unsafe, and so beyond the immediate political calculus in terms of not in my backyard, there was also a decision at some point, driven by political calculations, to move to the second pathway for destruction, which is a neutralization process, a hydrolysis process, which is essentially the chemical agent is drained. It's essentially diluted with hot water and sodium hydroxide. It's treated then as hazardous waste. It's stored in large cask and ultimately finds its way into deep repository. So there were. You're quite correct to say there was a not in my backyard attitude, which certainly delayed the program, which led to the a ballooning price tag. And bear in mind, in 1997, we estimated that the price tag of destroying those 31,000 tons of chemical ammunition would be about $2 billion, and today we're looking at a price tag of about $35 billion. And so those, as I say, local challenges also really led to additional delays in terms of we've got to change modalities in terms of how we destroy this agent, and we need to actually build facilities now to manage that process.
And we should all be a defense contractor, right? And be beneficiaries of those kind of cost overruns. So Brian Findley, back to the Syrian arsenal. My understanding is, and that you've written about this, where you've made reference to the AQ Khan network, which brought about Pakistan's secret nuclear weapons program, which is now one of the most vigorous, at least the fastest growing in the world. And then, of course, the proliferation to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. And a lot of it was uncovered when Gaddafi gave up his program. He operated AQ Khan through getting a lot of Western companies in the U.S., the Netherlands, Britain, Germany, Switzerland, etc., to cooperate with him. Maybe some of them may not have known what they were doing, but some of them may well have known what they were doing. I understand that the Assads have been basically up to the same thing, that they've been relying on a lot of Western countries, including, I believe, a company in Maine here in the United States, to get some of their precursors for the sarin, the very gas that was used on August the 21st.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it points to a much broader problem in truth, Ian, and it's one that is extremely distressing for security analysts and should be distressing for all of us. So you alluded quite rightly to the parallels between the AQ Khan network, AQ Khan being the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, really a hero in that country in terms of the first country, Islamic country, to cross the threshold and obtain a nuclear weapon. He operated a side business, though he was officially employed by the Pakistani government in aid of that nuclear program. He, as I say, ran a side business that essentially marketed sensitive nuclear knowledge and nuclear materials necessary to build nuclear weapons to a wide variety of countries, unbeknownst to us in the West and the wider international community for over a decade. That ultimately helped contribute to North Korea's nuclear program, to the Libyan nuclear program. We know he had contacts with Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi nuclear program. And we suspect as well, and there's some evidence to suggest, that he also had links with al-Qaeda and their interest in pursuing a nuclear weapon capability for terrorist use. The network that he employed was so vast and so shockingly sophisticated in two ways. One, by its sheer size, but two, by the fact that he operated it for so long unbeknownst to the international community. And this, in many ways, is also the story of the Assad regime in support of his chemical weapons. So, as you know, he developed a program, Assad, his chemical weapons program, in counterbalance to the Iraqi nuclear program. This is now in the 1980s, and essentially was aided, certainly, as Secretary Hagel has mentioned in his hearing, in his testimony on Capitol Hill a week or so ago, was certainly aided by the Russian government and other allied governments of the Syrian regime. But what is becoming increasingly apparent is it is not just the Russian government and the North Koreans that aided that program, but, as you pointed out, similar to the AQ Khan network, he managed to tap an international black market of chemical providers, and not just in those countries, but, as you also point out, in the Netherlands, here in the United States, in the United Kingdom. The inherent challenge in these technologies, similar to nuclear technologies, the inherent challenge with chemical technologies is that they are in many cases dual use, that they can be used produce fertilizers, to produce agents to build aluminum frames for windows, to make cosmetics, to a whole range of very legitimate commercial uses. But on the other hand, they can be also used to and diverted for nefarious purposes, and that is obviously what Bashar Assad has done over the course of a couple of decades in building what was and perhaps still is the world's third largest chemical weapon stockpile.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Brian Finley, but I guess just in closing, we obviously it's better to have this deal go through than not go through, but it's I guess the we can agree that it's a long way from being done, and it's going to take a lot longer, and I don't know how the U.S. is going to keep the threat of military force alive over that long period, but we'll wait and see, I guess.
Indeed, and it certainly is a problem, unfortunately, and that extends beyond Syria as well. And if the administration really is serious about controlling chemical weapons, there is much more that needs to be done in terms of breaking up these black market networks.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Brian Finley.
Thank you.
Again, Brian Finley is a chemical weapons expert and senior associate at the Stimson Center, where he directs the center's Managing Across Boundaries initiative. Previously, he was a senior researcher at the Brookings Institution and a program officer at the Century Foundation. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with an alternative scenario about what is behind all the turmoil in the Middle East. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nicholas Danforth, who's a doctoral candidate in Turkish history at Georgetown University. He's the editor of the cartography blog midafternoonmap.com and has an article at The Atlantic, Stop Blaming Colonial Borders for the Middle East's Problems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Danforth.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And let's begin with your midafternoonmap.com. What's that an allusion to?
My love of maps and my love of naps.
I see. All right. I thought you might be referring to the colonial authorities Sykes and Picot drawing up arbitrary maps in the middle of the afternoon.
No, good and bad maps can be drawn any time of day.
I see. Well, but your article in The Atlantic starts out reminding us of this very funny sketch, which I happened to see on The Daily Show, where John Oliver was dressed as a 19th century British explorer, and he's showing how these arbitrarily and carelessly drawn imperial borders are to blame for all that's wrong with the Middle East today. You, of course, take exception to that.
Right, and certainly cannot be anywhere near as funny as they were, but it was a remarkable skit. And it's credit to them that actually, I mean, that there are people making popular comedy about 1920s Middle Eastern history to get these conversations going.
Well, explain, though, where that thesis went wrong, because yesterday I spoke with Scott Anderson, the author of the new book, Lawrence in Arabia, and he took somewhat the opposite tack that you're taking. So I'm interested in getting your alternative view here.
Right. Well, when people talk about how arbitrary colonial borders are to blame for all the problems in the Middle East, I mean, my objection is really twofold. First, that I think it's worth noting these borders are not actually as arbitrary as people think they were. In many cases, they did bear some, albeit often vague, relationship to pre-existing Ottoman provisional boundaries, and we can talk about that more later. But what really frustrates me about this thesis is the idea that, not that these borders were necessarily the best ones, not that they were necessarily made with the best of intentions, but that when you say they're responsible for the region's problems, the implication is, of course, that there were better ones available. And when you start to think about what the different options were, what the different sets of alternative borders that the British and French could have drawn, you quickly start seeing that none of the alternatives were any better at all. And then you can't help thinking that, in fact, the real problem is there just aren't natural borders to divide up, you know, groups of people that have been living together for centuries and carve them into modern states without causing massive disruption, without causing massive violence. And when people talk about Middle Eastern borders as being artificial or arbitrary, there's this implied sense that there are countries out there without artificial borders, without arbitrary borders. And naturally, the implication is that somehow Western Europe is an example of real countries with real borders. And when you look at the last century or two of European history, I mean, obviously the idea that there was some intrinsic, obvious border between France and Germany, which if they just, you know, drawn in 1850, they could have avoided the last two world wars, seems ridiculous. I mean, that you have areas where you have different groups of people mixed together, places like Alsace-Lorraine, that inevitably become sites of competition and would ultimately determine whether or not that territory was France or Germany wasn't some boundary-drawing commission, but was the result of warfare.
Well, is there an example of what you would consider properly drawn borders, if there's such a notion?
The point I would try to make is that the issue isn't necessarily where the borders are drawn in the first place, but how people react to the borders that are drawn. And there, I think in my article I brought up the case of Jordan, which has one of the most purely artificial sets of borders in the Middle East. There's really no precedent for this state. And yet it's actually been one of the more stable parts of a violent region since then. And I would certainly, you know, looking at Europe obviously today, looking at other parts of the world, you know, it's what people make of the borders they're given. And at a certain point, you know, the Europeans, after two centuries of warfare, realize that instead of continuing to fight about their borders, they should cooperate, promote trade across those borders. And that, I think, is what ultimately leads to stability, rather than thinking that if you just keep tinkering with them, if you just try to get them right, you'll somehow be able to solve all of these problems.
Well, didn't the borders over Jordan have a lot to do with what happened essentially in Mecca, where the Hashemite kings were they are, after all, the correct lineage from the Prophet Muhammad, are they not?
Well, this is actually what's interesting, right? I mean, I guess when you think about Lawrence of Arabia's role in all of this, of the various people that he supported, the Hashemite dynasty, and Hussein, you know, that it was actually in many cases the Arabs that got rid of these rulers. What's now the Saudi government, the Saudi royal family, drove Lawrence's partner in the Arab revolt, Hussein, out of Mecca, conquered the area themselves, now it's part of Saudi Arabia. His successor, his son, Abdullah, who stayed in Jordan, actually was relatively successful. But the branch of the royal family that was sent to rule over Iraq was ultimately driven out and killed following a coup in 1958. So it's not like, you know, these rulers, these individuals, even when they were given territory, necessarily did a better job with it than the colonial officers.
And, of course, the fact that the Saudis now claim to be the custodians of Islam and the holy sites, which the Hashemite kings have a more legitimate claim, also leads you to the whole question of the Sunni-Shia split over the murder of Ali in this, 7th century, was it? 6th century?
Right. And this is also something that, exactly, when we're trying to look at these regions now and see what could have been done better, you know, the fantasy is somehow that you have this split that's gone back for 1,300 years. You have Sunnis, you have Shiites, and if only you could get them all in the right places, draw the right boundaries between them, you could eliminate all of the region's problems. And they're, you know, in part as we've seen in Iraq and today in Syria, I mean, when you have any group of people that have been living together in many cases peacefully for centuries, that just the populations are so intermixed, people are, you know, living in the same cities, living in the same villages, that this idea that somehow you can separate them, this idea that somehow you could create states where everyone would have the same idea of what a legitimate ruler would be based on their religious background and therefore could all live happily together, is a difficult one to achieve.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who's a doctoral candidate in Turkish history at Georgetown University. He's the editor of the cartography blog midafternoonmap.com, and he has an article at The Atlantic, Stop Blaming Colonial Borders for the Middle East's Problems. So let's get to the heart of what your article says is in many ways the real problems. It's certainly at the core of what is happening in Syria today in terms of a colonial legacy. And, you know, I did mention this in the interview I did yesterday. I also mentioned the Tutsis in Rwanda. And you write in terms of the pernicious divide and conquer strategy of the colonial French and the British. You say that the French cultivated the previously disenfranchised Alawite community in Syria as an ally against the Sunni majority. This involved recruiting and promoting Alawite soldiers in the territory's colonial army, thereby fostering their identity as Alawites and bringing them into conflict with local residents of other ethnicities. The French pursued the same policy with the Maronite Christians in Lebanon, just as the Belgians did with the Tutsis in Rwanda and the British did with the Muslims in India, Turks in Cyprus, and innumerable other groups elsewhere. So I must say I agree with that thesis. I think, isn't that the core of particularly what's happening in Syria today?
Well, I mean, that's certainly, at least from everything I can say about it, you know, especially when you look at Syria's history vis-a-vis borders, you know, the only complaint Syrians have ever had about their borders is they weren't big enough. They thought they should include Lebanon. They thought they should include part of Turkey. And yet now, obviously, the fight that you're having is between groups of people within, you know, the state of Syria that the French created. And that clearly, right, as you say, I think goes back in a much more direct way, in a much more, for European policy, very damning way to the strategy of divide and conquer that the French used.
Well, it engenders bitterness, doesn't it, with the majority. That's what happened with the Hutu in Rwanda that led to the genocide, their revenge against the haughty minority. And now you have the majority Sunni population in Syria trying to exact their revenge on this Alawite regime that has oppressed them for over 40 years.
Right. And then obviously, I mean, I think both what's so pernicious about the way the French use this policy, but then also as these things cycle down through the generations and as these conflicts continue in Syria, is that when you do have groups of people who don't necessarily see their ethnic differences as the defining feature in their lives, say, in many cases, Alawites and Sunnis 200 years ago, and then you start having a government, whether it's foreign or, in the case of Syria, domestic, that starts using those identities as a basis to consolidate its authority, starts recruiting people from various groups, getting them to fight in the army, you gradually do have these identities coalesce, become polarized. And so obviously, right in the case of Syria today. You have Alawites who in the very beginning might not have supported the Assad regime, might have been pro-democracy, but as these battle lines get drawn and as they become increasingly attached to ideas about religion, ideas about ethnic identity, then people, you know, only to promote their own survival, only to defend their own lives, start identifying with their ethnic compatriots when they might not have before. And, so, I mean, obviously the Rwandan case is one of the most horrific examples of what can result from that.
So what do you think then, Nicholas Danforth, as a cartographer, about talk of a even more divided Syria as the only way out of this current agony? There's been talk of eventually the Alawites retreating to the northwestern coast and the mountains. What's your sense of that?
Well, and I think one of the things that I would certainly point out when that gets discussed is that when you look at all the ethnographic maps that have been made, you look at the enormously visually complicated ways in which populations have intermingled, it's just a reminder of something that we've seen throughout history, which is that efforts to divide people up cleanly like that, you know, inevitably result in, if not, you know, murder and outright ethnic cleansing, tremendous displacement, tremendous suffering. And that's certainly something that people should keep in mind. That said, you know, unfortunately, one of the maybe more pessimistic conclusions is there are times when these identities become so divided, become so militarized to the point where they can't live together, that actually, you know, as seems to be the case in Bosnia, you know, dividing people up into different geographic regions is the lesser evil. But it's certainly worth keeping in mind that it is ultimately evil.
Well, it's interesting, though, isn't it, Nicholas Danforth, that so much of these tensions were kept under wraps during the Cold War, where the U.S. and the Russians fought against each other. They couldn't have a hot war because they would have destroyed each other with nuclear weapons, so they had a Cold War using surrogates to fight each other. Much of what we're talking about today was kept down, if you will. I mean, the best example being Tito ruling right. Yugoslavia. And then as soon as the Cold War ended, there was this explosion of these ethnic wars, and all of these subnational and transnational threats took over from the notion of a national threat. And it's hard to believe that we will actually see any great world wars between nations and coalitions of nations anymore. The globe seems to be more and more beset by transnational and subnational conflicts.
Right. I don't know if that's an optimistic assessment or a pessimistic assessment.
No, it's just an assessment.
No, right. I mean, obviously, in the Cold War, you certainly did have, at least, I mean, in the Soviet Union, in Yugoslavia, in China, still to some extent today, ideologies like communism, which actually in some ways could serve to bring together people across borders. And then in other places, you had the fear of communism, which was a driving ideological force that helped bring people together, create solidarity when it didn't exist. And unfortunately, when you know, the power dynamics in the world changed when the Cold War ended. Right. I mean, that these identities were always available as things that people could mobilize when they wanted to go to war with one another, when they had interest in going to war with one another.
So how do these things change? I mean, in other words, were the let's just deal with the Cold War borders. Were they artificial? And are these conflicts that we're seeing and emerging ethnic identities and splitting up countries, and the most recent one is Sudan, are they a process towards a more accurate ethnographic reality?
Well, what's actually really interesting about that, when you talk about accurate ethnographic realities in the Cold War, I mean, one of the biggest changes in terms of new nations that have come out of the Cold War is the independence of all these republics in Central Asia. And one of the things that's striking about those, I mean, now we look at them even more so than Eastern Europe, is being just impossibly complex and, I mean, if you want to talk about their borders, absurdly squiggly to the point where, you know, you have countries where it's impossible to drive from the capital to half of the country without driving through a different country. And one of the things I think is so interesting about this is that this came out of actually one of the most bizarrely idealistic and yet also cynical attempts to draw scientific accurate borders coming out of World War One, when both, you know, with Woodrow Wilson in the United States and in a very different way with Lenin in the Soviet Union, you had this idea that, much like, again, at the end of the Cold War, you were entering this new era where after the World War One, you could actually get these things right. You could draw appropriate boundaries. And so what happened in the Soviet Union is since they had this area that they were redividing into new national states, and yet they were at the same time supremely confident that it was always going to remain under Soviet power, they actually drew these, in some cases, remarkably, quote-unquote, accurate lines in order to get every single little village, every single group of people exactly on the right side of the border. And the result were these countries that now, all of a sudden, at the end of the Cold War, they've found themselves independent, and their borders are actually very unsuited for that.
So just in closing, Nicholas Danforth, returning to Syria, which is the best test-cake example of this pernicious divide-and-conquer strategy that the colonial French used to favor the Alawite minority over the Sunni majority and to rule through the Alawites. And I mentioned the idea of a new Alawite state being carved out. My understanding is that it's completely impractical because the Sunni state, assuming that the U.S.-Russian deal that's going to keep Assad in power and basically sell out the revolution against him, but assuming that it doesn't work and the civil war exhausts itself to the point where these people cannot live in a unified Syria, my understanding is that an Alawite state on the Mediterranean, if it denied the rump Sunni state access to the Mediterranean, wouldn't work. So how much do these factors, I mean, because I remember that in the Balkans Wars, that Milosevic made a push for the coast to give landlocked Serbia a port.
And I guess that's what I'd say might be one of the most discouraging lessons from all of this history and all of this talk of borders, is that when you start trying to imagine what it would look like to divide up some of these countries today, you find yourself back in the exact same place that people would have found themselves if they tried to do things differently almost a century ago. And exactly, I mean, everyone wants access to the coast. Everyone wants the best chunks of land. There are certain conflicts that are inherently there that no amount of clever border drawing, no amount of ingenious cartography can just paper over.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Nicholas Danforth.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who is a doctoral candidate in Turkish history at Georgetown University. He's the editor of the cartography blog midafternoonmaps.com and has an article at The Atlantic, Stop Blaming Colonial Borders for the Middle East's Problems. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.